From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The first Republican face-off. They called it a debate. Donald Trump took center stage, calling U.S. leaders stupid on immigration policy and blaming Mexico's leaders.
They send the bad ones over because they don't want to pay for them. They don't want to take care of them. Why should they when the stupid leaders of the United States will do it for them?
President Obama made a sharp case for the Iran nuclear deal, saying those opposed to it have not learned from the past.
Many of the same people who argued for the war in Iraq are now making the case against the Iran nuclear deal.
And Jon Stewart calls it a wrap. After hosting The Daily Show for 16 years, Jon Stewart said goodbye and thanked his audience.
Don't think that the energy that you put out is not received on those days where we just feel like we don't have it. And I'm very fond of you as well, sir.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Lisa Lear of the Associated Press, John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us also on air or online. Who stood out to you from the GOP debate and who fell flat? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Lisa Lear. She is national political reporter for the Associated Press. Lisa Lear, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from Washington is John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. John McCormick, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, as always, Jack Beatty is joining us. Hey, Jack.
Hello, John, Lisa, and John.
So last night's program, it turns out, according to Brian Stelter, who's been looking at the numbers over at CNN, the most watched primary debate, it's called a debate in history, 16% of all American households. For Fox, that's something like 8 to 10 times higher than its normal audience. So some sort of special electricity seemed to be fueling this event going in. Lisa Lear, what was that electricity?
Well, I think its name is the Donald, really. There was a lot of people were very, very interested to see how Donald Trump would behave on a debate stage. Would he bring the circus act? Would he bring more serious? And I think a more serious tone. I think Republicans who wanted Donald Trump to blow himself up in this debate are going to be disappointed. Once again, he defied political expectations. He took some tough questions. He stayed on the stage. And his answers may not have been what, you know, some in the Republican Party want to hear. He wouldn't rule out running as an independent, an outcome that many Republicans think would doom their party to losing the general election. But for his supporters, you know, he kept that sort of aggressive anti-establishment tone that, you know, has found a real niche in the Republican base. Look, this is a real problem for Republicans. They don't know how this story ends, and they don't know how they're going to be able, or if they're going to be able to get him out of the race. I mean, you can't really, if the party or some group of donors or moneyed Republicans decide to run ads against Donald Trump, that could certainly backfire. Part of his appeal is that he's positioned himself against official Washington. So I think Reince Priebus, the head of the Republican Party, is waking up to a little bit, a big feeling of nerves this morning.
Jack Beatty, did Trump make the show last night?
John, the only question is, how did Trump do? People don't care how Huckabee did. They want to know how Trump did. And the answer is, I did good. I did good, John. I repeat myself. You want to know why? To keep talking, John. To fill the air with words. To say nothing. But say it fast and confidently and again and again. For example, this Iran deal, it's a bad deal. Why is it a bad deal? I'll tell you why it's a bad deal. Because schmucks negotiated. That's why it's a bad deal. Losers like Kerry. He lost to Bush. I mean Bush, the guy who starts the Iraq war, and Kerry loses to him. What deal would I have made, John? A better deal, a terrific deal, because I make deals, deals with China, deals with Mexico, deals with Bill Clinton, and this deal with Iran, no way I make that deal. Top of the world, Ma.
John McCormick, I want to bring you into the conversation as well on the point of the Donald, but let's listen to a little bit of what happened last night early in the debate when Fox's Megyn Kelly asked him about his rhetoric in the language he's used in talking about women. She said, you've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. And she said, does that sound to you, Mr. Trump, like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And his response went like this.
frankly, what I say, and oftentimes it's fun, it's kidding, we have a good time. What I say is what I say. And honestly, Megan, if you don't like it, I'm sorry. I've been very nice to you, although I could probably maybe not be based on the way you have treated me, but I wouldn't do that.
John McCormick, what about that?
You know, I thought that was a very interesting exchange and probably explained the Trump appeal, such as it is, more than any position he's taken on immigration or trade or China or anything. You know, it's the whole – he went on to say, you know, I hate political correctness. I don't have time for it. And I think that's really what people like about Trump. You know, there's polls saying that it's a fact that he tells it like it is. And I think that might be a fact. I mean, there are people out there, I'm sure, who are like Donald Trump in that they are, you know, vulgar and crass and terrible. But I'm sure there are other people, too, who just feel that this country becomes increasingly politically politically correct, that they're going to celebrate anybody who's politically incorrect, no matter how vulgar they are. And I would say that, you know, maybe the more politically correct our country becomes, the uglier the backlash will be, and hence Donald Trump's appeal. You know, beyond that, I think that the debate was really interesting in that it showed that there's a really impressive and exciting field outside of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I think the RNC made a big mistake by delaying the debates until now. Mm-hmm. Had you been holding debates since May, I think that Republican primary voters actually getting a chance to look on these candidates side by side, all 10 of them, you know, I don't think that Donald Trump would have surged the way he did, because what happened basically over the summer is there was a vacuum because there were no debates. The other candidates weren't making news. And the entire media, I'm not singling out anybody, but Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, all the newspapers followed Donald Trump no matter what he did, no matter what he said. You know, I mean, he would make bombastic comments about, Mexican immigrants, but other times he would do basically nothing and all the networks would be covering him. So basically, it was Trump 24/7. Last night, people got a chance to see different candidates. I think they'll be impressed with what they saw. It was a strike in contrast with 2012 and how weak that field was, how strong this field is with a variety of intelligent, articulate, young, fresh faces. So I think that was really interesting to see.
Well, and I find it interesting, John, what you're talking about, the timing and the opportunity to see other candidates do things in a debate format. I question whether what we saw last night should ever even be called a debate, in the sense that we did not see candidates debating with each other, with very, very few exceptions. The format is set up in such a way, it reminds me a little bit more of the beauty pageant moment where everybody has to answer a question, but they don't really talk to each other. And I think maybe that's just baked into the fact that Fox had 10 people on the stage in 2 hours. Even if you gave everybody and took no commercials, the maximum anybody would get to talk would be 12 minutes, and it didn't work out that way. So, Lisa Lear, I mean, would you call what we saw last night a debate?
I mean, I would. I think actually the Fox moderators handled this very well. There were a lot of candidates on the stage. 10 is a lot of people to have in a debate stage. Everyone did get a chance to talk, and there were some exchanges between the candidates that gave us an indication of the kinds of issues the Republican Party will be grappling with in this primary season. One of them, of course, was this exchange between Chris Christie and Rand Paul over civil liberties and NSA. There was an exchange over education and
Let me break in, and Lisa Lear, let's listen to that exchange that you're just referring to. This is Chris Christie and Rand Paul talking about government surveillance.
How are you supposed to know, Megan?
Use the Fourth Amendment.
How are you supposed
to? Use the Fourth Amendment.
No, I'll tell you how you
get a warrant.
Let me tell you something. You
get a judge to sign
when
a
warrant. You know, Senator.
Go ahead, wait, Governor Christie, make your point.
Listen, Senator, you know, when you're sitting in a subcommittee just blowing hot air about this, you can say things like that. When you're responsible for protecting the lives of the American people, then what you need to do is to make sure that you use the system the way it's supposed to work. Here's the problem, Governor.
You fundamentally misunderstand the Bill of Rights.
So, Jack Beatty, not only was that great atmospherics, but I would say it was one of the few moments in the whole evening when you actually heard an exchange of ideas and not just a lot of people being interviewed by the Fox panel.
Real debate there, and it highlighted a real difference, the Republican hawkish wing, and as Rand Paul said, I'm a different sort of Republican. The polls suggest that he's too different, that he's out of phase with the hawkish mood of Republican voters now. We'll have to see. I did feel that just in terms of the oratorical oomph that Christie got the better of this. But, you know, I thought, to me, the best comment on the debate, just in terms of what the Republicans needed to do, came from Dana Milbank in the Washington Post, who pointed out, he went back to the autopsy. Remember that? The report that the Republican National Committee released after the 2012 election, saying, here's why we lost. Here's what we need to do. They said, you know, we need to be more inclusive of women, more tolerant of gays, more support comprehensive immigration reform to appeal to Latinos and so on. And he says, well, you know, with the 17 Republican candidates looking at both debates, he says, for 3 hours, Americans saw candidates opposing abortion, even in cases of rape or incest, to save a mother's life, so much for being inclusive of women, comparing the Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage to the one supporting slavery that came from the ineffable Rick Santorum, and talking about building borders and denying amnesty, so much for currying favors with Latino voters. In short, given the structural problems the GOP has, last night's debate, just by the 2013 autopsy, was a disaster.
Let's have a
John. Jack makes a really good point here. I actually spent debate night watching it in the Clinton campaign headquarters here in Brooklyn, and I have to say that the Clinton folks were making many of the same points. They thought this was a good night for them. They were making many of the same points that Jack was making, that having a bunch of male candidates on a stage talking about issues like abortion and women's health is a good thing for them in the general election. They particularly pointed out that the Republican candidates didn't mention anything about a path to citizenship, an important issue to Latino voters. So I think the Clinton folks were feeling pretty good.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the week in the news after the first presidential debate of the season. We're joined by Lisa Lear, national political reporter for the Associated Press, and John McCormick, senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. And we are hearing from a lot of you via Twitter and on our website. We just heard this from a person identifying as Aaron4, says, Trump does not tell it like it is. What a load of BS your guest is speaking. Sorry, guest. Omaha guy says, so far the only reasonable Republican choice that a liberal could possibly consider is Kasich. At least he's willing to think things through. Sam Winston says that Christie-Rand Paul exchange was the most childish stuff I've ever seen in politics. Let's bring in Jay from Saratoga, New York. Jay, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi. Your take from last night?
I felt that Fox attacked Trump immediately. I think that they failed to ask him the important questions. I felt that that's what it was all about, was attacking Trump.
Interesting take. And that Fox, you see Fox as having been beating up on Trump. I think probably a lot of people would say that they were certainly went in there deciding to go hard on him. Let's bring in Amber from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Amber, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi. What was your take on last night?
I think I should identify as a Democrat, and I'm 22. Mm-hmm. And going to the debate, my favorite was Kasich, but I was really surprised by Rand Paul, because unlike a lot of the candidates, he straight wasn't his talking points. He was very fiery. He wasn't as robotic as the other candidates, and he really stood out to me as a young person who recently graduated from college. I think that we need a presidential candidate who's not, I guess, political in that sense.
Could you see yourself voting for him?
I would. I do prefer Kasich. I think his resume trumps all the rest of the candidates. But if Rand Paul was a presidential candidate, depending if Hillary or potentially Bernie Sanders made the nomination, I would consider it.
All right, Amber, thanks for making your call in. And John McCormick, interesting to hear now this self-identified Democrat talking about two of the candidates who were not Trump, which goes to your point, I think, that what happened last night actually was not a total Trumparama, that in fact people were able to get a good look at some of the other people on that stage.
Definitely. And, you know, to that specific point about a young Democrat being impressed with Rand Paul, I think that's true, that a lot of people who are Democratic leaning like his ideas, his non-interventionism. You know, one problem for Rand Paul is that they're not going to vote in the Republican primary. I thought your other caller's point about the Fox guests attacking Trump. You know, he's the front runner. The front runner always takes the most heat. But I was impressed by how tough the questions were for all the candidates. And I thought all the questions for Trump were very on point. I mean, the idea that you would run in a Republican primary and not pledge to support the Republican nominee. Well, that's a big deal. You got to be asked that up front. You want to run as a Republican in a conservative party and support Canadian-style socialist single-payer health care. That doesn't play very well. And he said that, you know, the Canadian health care system works. It's really, that's what I said. You know, it's remarkable, you know, the fact that he's doing so well in the Republican primary. You know, that would be toxic for any candidate to hold. That's to the left of President Obama, of Nancy Pelosi on health care. And yet this guy is getting support of people who call themselves conservatives simply because they like his bluster.
Yeah, and interestingly, Salir, what John just said about the kinds of questions that the Fox panel was asking, they're getting good reviews all around. And I don't know if it's almost with a sense of surprise for people who don't normally tune into Fox, but it seems as though they thought this through, not only the awful logistics of having 10 people on a stage and what do you do with that in 2 hours, but they really thought through who they were going to be in this program.
Yeah, I think they really did a very good job. And one thing that I was very impressed with was that they seemed to zero in on each candidate's liability. For Jeb, that was a question about his positions on immigration. For Rand Paul, it was foreign policy. For Kasich, it was expanding Medicare in his state, you know, taking federal funds to do that. And for Trump, it was his tone, his bombasticness. And I think it was pretty clear in the debate that Trump is someone who doesn't have a lot of substantive policy positions, that his immigration plan consists, in his words, of deporting everyone who's in the country illegally and then bringing back the good guys and leaving the bad guys behind. I think that really came through. I'm just not sure it matters. He's speaking to a feeling, a sentiment in the country that big business and big politics are aligned and against the little guy. And that's a feeling that's running strong in both parties. That's part of that kind of feeling is part of what's fueling Bernie Sanders' rise on the left. So and you saw it particularly in the debate that, you know, no candidate other than Rand Paul really went after Trump particularly hard because they want to capture some of that energy rather than target his supporters. And so that was a really interesting moment. It was also a problem for Ted Cruz, who sort of had positioned himself in that arena as the truth teller, the guy who will put it to anyone in Washington. He really didn't get a lot. He didn't stand out in this debate. And I think because that's in part because Trump is in his political space now.
Jack Beatty, who was the candidate last night that you kept forgetting was actually on the stage until a question went to him?
Cruz, certainly. He seemed to disappear. I don't know what the numbers say. The numbers, I guess, say that Carson got the least amount of time. But, you know, there's some – just to go back to this question of Fox and their first – Brett Baer's first question. Mm-hmm. Will you forswear running as a third-party candidate? No, I won't. I want my leverage. Well, there's some evidence that that is hurting Trump already. I mean, you have to scratch for it. But Frank Luntz, for example, his focus group on Fox before the debate. How many people are for Trump? Forest of hands. After the debate, a couple of trees. Why? They all said, this guy wants to elect Hillary Clinton. We're Republicans. He wants to wreck our party. Why the heck are we, you know, I can't understand why I was so enthusiastic for a guy who basically is working for the Clintons. So if that is, if there's more legs to that perception, the Trump's rendezvous with reality could come sooner than we think.
Let's bring in Carl from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, welcome to On Point.
You know, guys, if they were trying to get the old white male vote, congratulations, Republican candidates, you got that sold up. And let's be honest with ourselves. They don't like Trump because he speaks the truth and he speaks to what they feel. No, they like him because of his racist comments he made coming out of the gate. Not one mention of the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act being signed by President Johnson. Not one. On the anniversary, on the 50th anniversary, not once. And that just let me know exactly what this Republican Party is all about. They're selfish. They're greedy. They could care less about anyone that looked like me. And by the way, I'm black. By anyone that looks like me, anyone that's not rich. And the kicker, the thing that was most disturbing was the last question, and these people sitting up here on this stage invoking God and talking about how much they love God and how Christian they are. But right after that, they'll tell you how they're going to cut social programs for poor people. there's nothing godlike about these people. It's an abomination to our country, and I'd be glad when we just flush them down the toilet and go the way.
All right, Carl, I see where you're going. Let's. Thanks for your call, Carl. Let's bring in Craig from Cedar Rapids. Craig, you're welcome to On Point. Hi.
John, I was really upset with Fox News because it's just indicative of what the media doesn't get. This is election is supposed to be of the people, by the people, and for the people. And the media for decades have been trying to manipulate the elections and these debates. They pitted the candidates against one another. Your previous caller is just an example. What's wrong with this country? We need to work together as fellow Americans seeking the best decisions for the American people. But it's all about power, money, and votes.
But what are you saying, Craig, that Fox did wrong? Craig,
we just stay divided, and the media just helps that happen.
So you're saying that they spent too much time.
Donald Trump says this.
Craig, I just want to ask you a question. I just want to clarify what you're saying. So you're saying that Craig is gone. I'm afraid. Sorry. It sounded, Craig, as though you were saying that you felt that the questions were too focused on trying to focus on the negative, some of which, in fact, I think, as John McCormick pointed out, they were pointing to their liabilities on purpose, and I think that added to some of the spark last night. Let's bring in Roger from Florence, South Carolina. Roger, welcome to On Point.
Yes, I think Trump is still playing the game of getting his issues on the table. I think there's some big clues last night where he's using that third-party threat, and in a post-debate interview, he says that he's just using it as leverage. So he's looking at it as a game plan to keep his positions on thing. And also, a president has to put his investments into a blind trust. Do you think Donald Trump could stand ever doing that? I don't think so.
All right, Roger, thanks for your call. It's interesting how Trump is still even dominating this conversation, and let's turn a corner in that regard, because there was that debate that took place 4 hours before, where the seven candidates who did not make the cut for the grown-ups table held an hour and a half debate moderated by different hosts on Fox in front of a mostly empty stadium. And it's felt, generally speaking, that one candidate did quite well in that, and that's former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina. And she, in her closing statement, was questioning Jeb Bush's campaign abilities and asking for his support.
2016 is going to be a fight between conservatism and a Democrat Party that is undermining the very character of this nation. We need a nominee who is going to throw every punch, not pull punches, and someone who cannot stumble before he even gets into the ring. I am not a member of the political class. I am a conservative. I can win this job. I can do this job. I need your help. I need your support.
Lisa Lear, why is everybody talking about Carly Fiorina this morning?
She had a good night. She was extremely fluent. She seemed comfortable on the stage. She was comfortable talking about complicated foreign policy, domestic issues. I honestly wouldn't be surprised if in the next debate we see her on the main stage. That's certainly an outcome that many in the Republican Party leadership would like. They would like to have a stage that isn't largely white men, that has a bit more diversity. She could offer that, particularly given that the likely Democratic nominee on the Democratic side still seems to be Hillary Clinton. Someone else that I think is worth mentioning is having a good night is John Kasich, the governor of Ohio. Granted, it was a hometown crowd. He got a lot of support in the room. Cheers for various things he said.
One of those, Lisa, was when he had a question about gay marriage, actually, and his answer was very passionate on that one. Let's just listen to what he had to say.
The court has ruled, and I said we'll accept it. And guess what? I just went to a wedding of a friend of mine who happens to be gay. Because somebody doesn't think the way I do, doesn't mean that I can't care about them or I can't love them. So if one of my daughters happened to be that, of course I would love them and I would accept them. Because you know what? That's what we're taught when we have strong faith.
John McCormick, what'd you think of that moment?
I thought it was a good moment. You know, of course, I would love my child no matter what is the proper Christian response, and only this radical caricature of Christianity that's out there in popular imagination would disagree with that statement in a radical fringe. So I thought it was a very good moment for him. I thought it was, you know, for all this talk about, you know, Democrats are excited that it was a, you know, a not a very diverse field. You know, Carly Fiorina, she was very impressive. Republicans have exactly the same number of women running in their party as Democrats do in their party. Mm-hmm. The Democrats, when they're on stage, is going to be a bunch of old white people. Last night, you saw two impressive Latinos, young Latinos, and one African-American neurosurgeon, brain surgeon. I thought that was very impressive.
Jack Beatty, Marco Rubio, what did you make of his performance last night?
I thought he did very well. I mean, he came across obviously as young and spirited, and there was a sort of warmth and generosity about him. Of course, when he started to talk about abortion and, oh, no, no, I don't want to make any exceptions for the life of the mother, I thought, oh, my God, here we are again. But other than that, which I thought was an off note, he seemed a human and compelling figure, and of course he invoked his father's story and the bar son of a bartender and student debt, and he set himself up for the fall. He says, you know, Hillary Clinton, who talked about dead broke, leaving the White House with Bill Clinton with his $900,000 pension and benefits, dead broke. And he says, I know what it means to live from paycheck to paycheck. That's also a Kasich line, and we're going to hear a lot more about that.
A man up there last night with a very famous last name, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. It's interesting that he is not at top of conversation after Trump, but let's listen to a little bit of what he said.
I'm going to have to earn this. Maybe the bar is even higher for me. That's fine. I've got a record in Florida. I'm proud of my dad, and I'm certainly proud of my brother. In Florida, they call me Jeb because I earned it. I cut taxes every year, totaling $19 billion. We balanced every budget.
Lisa Lear, how'd he do?
You know, there were a lot of concerns among the Republican political class, people who support Bush going into this debate, that he was a little rusty. He's someone who hasn't done this since leaving the Florida governor's mansion quite a few years ago. And I don't think he did much to dispel those concerns. He had a couple good answers, but he seemed a little tentative. More concerning, I think, for Bush is that Kasich really moved into his space, this sort of happy warrior space, a guy that can present a view of compassionate conservatism, something that could, you know, give the party a better chance of winning in a general election. Now, granted, both those guys will have to contend with a Republican base, the primary base, that seems to be much more in a fighting mood. But I don't think Bush emerged as a major player in this debate. Mm-hmm. Of course, he still has a massive financial advantage. He's raised a lot more money than anyone else. So certainly that'll help him. And we're in the very early phases of this primary season. This was the first debate, so there's plenty of time for him to make a bit of a comeback.
Yeah, well, John McCormick, do you think that Bush needs to do it differently next time?
I think so. You know, I think he kind of fell a little flat. I mean, he was solid, but the fact that you saw all these young, fresh faces, charismatic faces, you know, the spirit of 2014 was mm-hmm. candidates like Joni Ernst and Tom Cotton and Dan Sullivan, all these 40-something young, impressive people, a number of them veterans. There weren't any veterans on stage last night, but I do think that Jeb really does need to seem more fresh. I did think that Rubio was the most impressive candidate. You know, he has the most natural talent, the most charisma. I think that shined through, as Jack said. Jack was right. I think he got Walker confused with Rubio, but they both got tripped up on questions of abortion. I think they made mistakes by not talking about the fact that the laws that they support do include those exceptions. They were talking about their principles. The principle, the easy thing to say is, I believe all life is sacred. Every abortion ban at any stage in pregnancy has always included a life with a mother exception. Even taxpayer-funded abortion has included an exception for rape and incest. They need to be talking about Hillary Clinton's extremism, late term abortion, unhealthy children, you know, taxpayer-funded abortion. That's what they need to be talking about.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. And in other news this week, blazes take over California as a massive wildfire continues burning. Some residents have been able to return to their homes, but not everybody. Here's Peggy O'Day of Clear Lake, California.
We could see the flames cresting up over the hill and coming into the back of the valley, and that's when we decided we need to go.
And this week marks 70 years since the United States dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. At a ceremony, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe spoke out against nuclear weapons.
We have to continue our effort to achieve the world without nuclear weapons.
And a Stradivarius violin stolen 35 years ago is back in the hands of the family of American concert violinist and music professor Roman Totenberg. His daughter and NPR's legal correspondent Nina Totenberg said that the theft was devastating to her father.
He never laid eyes on it again. And it was a crushing blow because it had been, as he put it, his musical partner for 38 years.
And you can join our conversation. What are you thinking about Jon Stewart leaving The Daily Show and Amy Schumer speaking out on gun control and the president making his case for the Iran nuclear deal? So Lisa Lear of the Associated Press, John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, and Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, are all with me. And let's listen to what the president had to say on the Iran deal, speaking at American University Wednesday, obviously in support of the deal. President Obama said America has to get out of the mindset that led to the decade of war in Iraq and instead turn to diplomacy to ensure a safer world.
How can we, in good conscience, justify war before we've tested a diplomatic agreement that achieves our objectives, that has been agreed to by Iran, that is supported by the rest of the world, and that preserves our options if the deal falls short? How could we justify that to our troops? How could we justify that to the world or to future generations? In the end, that should be a lesson that we've learned from over a decade of war.
Jack Beatty, his choice of rhetoric, what do you make of it?
Well, I thought it was a very powerful speech. You know, by toppling Saddam Hussein, we really upset the balance of power in the Gulf and brought an Iran-friendly regime to power in Baghdad. Thus, you know, the advocates of the Iraq War could not have done more to help Iran than if they were its paid agents. And the president was right. The mindset that led to that war is still regnant on the right. And he's right that the mindset is a belief in war as the first instrument in international relations. And not only that, in preventive war, war in the subjunctive. If Iraq has nukes, it might give them to terrorists. Bismarck compared preventive war to a man who kills himself from fear of death. If Congress rejects the Iran deal, we'll be on course for another preventive war. The cry will be, if Iran gets nukes, it might attack Israel. Preventive war is deeply immoral. It assumes the future can be known. It makes great nations prisoners of fear. And in practice, preventive war is inordinately counterproductive. Michael Hayden, the former Bush CIA director, says attacking Iran would guarantee that the mullahs would build a bomb and have the nation behind them. The president is right. Only diplomacy can keep Iran from getting this.
And yet, John McCormick, how effective is this choice of rhetoric in winning support for the deal in Congress?
Well, the way things have worked out with this being an executive agreement and the president signing this requiring two-thirds majority of Congress to invalidate it or to stop it, he doesn't have to worry about Republicans. He has to worry about Democrats. Mm-hmm. And he suffered a devastating blow last night when Chuck Schumer of New York, number three ranking Democrat who is likely to become the majority leader, said he does not support this deal. The problem isn't right-wing Republicans. The problem is that Democrats think it is a bad deal. The president himself has said that the funding, the sanctions relief, will be able to fund terrorism. That's just a really difficult position. What do we get for it? Not much.
And Lisa Lear, I mean, Chuck Schumer's decision to vote against this is devastating, but was it a surprise?
I don't think it was that much of a surprise. Certainly everybody was watching Chuck Schumer very closely on this issue. He's likely to be the next Senate Majority Leader, so his voice is important. There's some speculation that he wouldn't have come out against the deal unless the White House was fairly confident that they could sustain a veto. I mean, there is, as John McCormick pointed out, a growing sense that the way this deal will be implemented will be by a presidential veto, which is frankly not the ideal way to implement a major piece of foreign policy, but it looks like how it's going to turn out. And I think there's also a sense that the House, you know, in order to do this, the White House has to get one-third plus one of either the House or the Senate. And it looks like the House will be the firewall here. And I think that's part of why you've seen the president escalate his rhetoric a little bit. That's what folks in the House who tend to be a little bit more partisan Democrats, that's the kind of thing that they want to hear. Those are the kind of arguments that resonate with them. You know, but the Senate's still uncertain. He may get one-third plus one, those 34 votes in the Senate. It's just not all that clear yet. And it's worth pointing out that while Schumer came out against the deal, Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, also in Senate leadership, has come out in favor of it. So, you know, it's a work in progress, and we'll have to see what happens when all these Congress people come back from their time at home over the August recess.
Let's bring in John from Austin, Texas. John, welcome to On Point.
Hi, I'm John. I just have a question that I need to understand as an American and as a voter. Why is it that we allowed other countries paying lobbying to decide on America's future? Why is it that we allow, in this particular case, other countries like, for example, Israel, just to mention one, pay these lobbying people to influence the senators that we elected, the people that we voted to represent us, and they're making the decisions based on other countries' best interest?
Well, let me bring that. Let me bring that question then to John McCormick, sort of how it's played. And of course, you know, we know also that Israel's ambassador to the United States has been working Capitol Hill, and that's all very above board. I mean, everybody sees him coming and going. So, just to answer John's question, the influence of people who are not Americans on a decision like this Iran deal.
I think that there are plenty of Americans who think that Israel is one of our strongest and best allies and have an affinity for Israel. I think Americans are also concerned about America. You know, the question is, you know, I think that at the end of the day, the question is, you know, is the Islamic Republic of Iran, can they be, are they a conventional enemy?
I think John's question wasn't what's in America's best interest. I think his question was, is it right that people who are not Americans are able to influence the political process?
I don't understand what he's really asking. I mean, people from other countries, we have allies all over the world who have opinions. The French, you know, or the Germans can express an opinion about whether something is good or bad, and so can the Israelis. I think that that's just the give and take, and the idea that there's something sinister, that there is some sort of, you know, fifth column is, you know, it sometimes goes into a smear. It goes beyond just why Israel is singled out for, you know, their opinions on foreign affairs and not other countries. I find a little questionable.
It's worth pointing out also that Israel is not the only country lobbying on this deal. The ambassadors from England, from Germany, from France, who support the Iran deal, have also been on Capitol Hill talking to various members of Congress, making the rounds. So this is a big international agreement with repercussions across the world. So, you know, certainly those other nations are going to want to make their views heard.
And the Arab states behind the scenes oppose us too. So it's not just an Israeli thing.
Very evocative speech heard this week from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren on the Senate floor, criticizing Republicans who were voting to defund Planned Parenthood.
Do you have any idea what year it is? Did you fall down, hit your head, and think you woke up in the 1950s or the 1890s? Should we call for a doctor? Because I simply cannot believe that in the year 2015, the United States Senate would be spending its time trying to defund women's health care centers.
Jack Beatty, update us on that story.
Well, of course, this is about the defund Planned Parenthood movement, provoked by the you know, espionage, really, or the videos on the Planned Parenthood doctors talking blithely about parts of babies and so on. That was, everybody seemed to be upset about that, and it's upsetting. There was nothing illegal in it. But, you know, it's even beyond that. As Nick Kristof pointed out in a column called Our Sex-Crazed Congress, it goes beyond that. The Republicans want to attack and really destroy Title X, which is the Title X, which is the all of the government programs on planning, on family planning. And the upshot of this would be it would increase abortions by something like 350,000 a year. More pregnancies, more abortions, he says, more AIDS, more sexually transmitted infections, more women dying of cervical and breast cancer. And why? Because I guess some conservative Republicans just don't like the idea of family planning. So it goes beyond just Planned Parenthood.
And also an evocative speech on the Senate from the Senate, Oklahoma Senator James Lankford called for a transfer of funding from Planned Parenthood to other women's health clinics.
Let's take the funding that has been committed to Planned Parenthood, who is the single largest abortion provider in the country. 40% of their revenue comes from the federal taxpayer. For the single largest provider of abortion in the country to stop and to say, let's take that funding, let's commit it to organizations that do full women's health, mammograms, testing, contraceptives, the works.
John McCormick, where is this going, this story?
I think it's not going anywhere. You know, the real scandal here is what's legal. It's not what's illegal. The fact that, you know, this was undercover. You know, I wouldn't call it espionage as Jack did. I would say this is, no more than 60 minutes undercover investigations are espionage. You have high-level Planned Parenthood officials not using the anesthetized language of, terminating a pregnancy, otherizing, dehumanizing the unborn child by calling it a fetus. You have the officials in their own world saying words like, it's a baby, another boy, crushing the skull, not disarticulating a cat. Calvarium. You have talking about crushing here, crushing there, so you can get the baby's heart or liver and sell it, and then sell it for $130, $100 to a biotech company, which will in turn sell it again. It's just really unmasked. All this language that's surrounding the abortion debate for 30 years.
Let's move on to another story. We're bringing Chuck Schumer back into the program. This is in reference to the incident late in July where a gunman opened fire in a movie theater in Louisiana and killed two people and wounded nine others. The movie they were watching happened to be called Trainwreck, stars Amy Schumer, who is the cousin of Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer of New York. And on Monday, Amy Schumer called for new legislation limiting gun access for the mentally ill.
We need a background check system without holes and fatal flaws. We need one with accurate information that protects us like a firewall. The critics scoff and say, well, there's no way to stop crazy people from doing crazy things, but they're wrong. There is a way to stop them. Preventing dangerous people from getting guns is very possible.
Lisa Lear, this is one where it has been said that the president has more or less thrown up his hands. Is that an accurate description, and does Amy Schumer have any influence on this conversation?
Look, if we can't pass the Congress can't pass background checks or any kind of new gun laws after 20 kids are murdered in their elementary school in Connecticut, I'm not sure Amy Schumer is going to move the debate. You know what I mean? It does certainly feel in Washington that there is very little momentum for moving anything, even the kinds of relatively minor legislation that Amy Schumer and her cousin, Senator Chuck Schumer, are talking about, things that would reward states that submit comprehensive data to the national background check system and penalize those that don't. And, you know, they called on the Justice Department to recommend how states should deal with guns and mental health and make sure Congress fully funds mental health and substance abuse programs. These are not really sweeping gun control. This is not really sweeping gun control legislation, but it's just hard to see how anything gets done on this issue, particularly now, as last night showed us, we're really fully in the 2016 presidential cycle.
All right, let's move back to some of our listeners and bring in Joe from Littleton, New Hampshire. Joe, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Yeah, I was just one of those. I heard you mention the demise of the Jon Stewart show or the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and I'm one of the many people who am really kind of mourning his passing. I'm sure I'll watch to see whoever takes over from him. But just a quick anecdote. I was at down on Sandwich on Cape Cod in Massachusetts with a few old friends from high school. A couple of my old pals are real dyed-in-the-wool Tea Party Republicans. And we'd interrupted our dinner for a brief talk about the Republican presidential debate, and we had a quick kind of argument about Donald Trump. And somehow the conversation shifted to Jon Stewart, and both of these friends of mine, like I said, who are Tea Party Republicans, really lamented the passing of his show. And I looked at him and I was like, how can you guys watch Jon Stewart? I mean, you're going to vote for Donald Trump. And they looked at me like I was an idiot, and I said, well, he's funny. And it just, I don't know, it was just, it was a magical moment, and coming just at the end of his show where he's just the kind of, I don't know if you call him a comic or a pundit or what, that we just have a real paucity of in this country. And I think his passing is a milestone, and I'm sure someone will try to take up the slack.
In his spirit, Joe, thanks for your call. In his spirit, as we wrap our program, as Jon Stewart always ended the Daily Show with a moment of Zen from the news. I think we actually had one last night from Ben Carson, who was on that stage with the other nine candidates in the second and the big boy debate, and he had something to say about what it takes to be president. So Ben Carson's moment of Zen.
The thing that is probably most important is having a brain and to be able to figure things out and learn things very rapidly.
Lisa Lear, very quickly, your thought on Ben Carson's thought.
I think brains are good. Having a brain is good. And Jon Stewart seems to be this generation's Johnny Carson, right? This feels like a major moment for people in the news, people who are involved with the news, who like the news. It'll be interesting to see how his replacement fares.
Okay. It sounds like we all vote for brains. I want to thank everybody for joining us. Lisa Lear, national political reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks so much for joining us. John McCormick, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Thanks to you, too.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, our news On Point news analyst. As always, thanks, Jack.
Thank you, John.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.